Blog Talk Radio.
We are the heirs of that first revolution.
Will a strong and united America still be a force for freedom and prosperity around the world?
America has created the longest peacetime economic expansion in our history.
We are the heirs of that first revolution.
Good common sense and sound judgment of the American people. And their essential love of justice.
Hi, welcome to the Kudzu Vine for Sunday, May 15th, 2016. I'm your host, David McLaughlin. Joining me as always, welcome Catherine Smith.
Greetings from Atlanta.
And welcome Tim Shiflett.
Good evening, sir.
All right, in about 20 minutes. Excited to have Scott Elliott return from election projection. The last time we had Scott on was before the 2014 race. And if you haven't looked at his site, take a chance. Election projection. Scott does a great job of not only, you know, looking at some data and making projections about the electoral map. He actually does a popular vote projection. He looks at some of the House and Senate races as well. So we're going to talk to Scott about all that here in just a bit. But until then, we're going to get a little local and talk some Georgia stuff. I wish we could get some of our pre-show back. We were all heated, not even mad at each other. What was the funniest thing? We were seeing who could be the maddest, but none of the three of us are mad at each other. But let's get into that. And this week, the U.S. Senate, actually there's a U.S. Senate primary both ways. Johnny Isaacson actually has two Republican challengers. One, he refuses to debate because of a charge 17 years ago, even though the guys run before Derek Grayson and people have debated him for. I don't know. I think that's more of a ploy just to not get in front of the, have to have a debate. And then on the Democratic side, you have one candidate, John Coyne, suing the Democratic Party because he believes that the Democratic Party of Georgia made a backroom deal, in his words, with Jim Barksdale. And you have Cheryl Copeland, who's not in the middle of this thing, which I think in some ways helps her. Catherine, I think you've maybe seen more of the candidates than we have. What are your thoughts on this Democratic race?
Well, I have to be honest, I haven't looked very closely at, what was her name, Copeland.
Isn't it Copeland? Yeah.
I've seen Jim Barksdale in person, and I've seen his new television commercial. And I've read about John Coyne. I think John Coyne is, he went on this rant against Greg Bluestein and the AJC, and then he sued the party. I get it. He's frustrated because he feels like the fix is in. And, I mean, we've all seen candidates like that before, and how you respond to that is telling, and suing the party is not the best way to respond to it. And then that rant in the AJC was great. Well, that he wrote to the AJC that he published on his website was just kind of crazy. Like, in the time it took him to write that, he probably could have knocked on a couple hundred doors or made, a couple hundred calls to potential voters or donors, and he wouldn't have looked like such a fool with misspellings and, it was just whoever's advising him should have advised him not to print that.
Catherine, so you're saying that he shouldn't have gone after Mike Burlow and the gross domestic product for what they did? Because he did call them the GDP,
which is commonly the
acronym for gross domestic product, not DPG, Democratic Party of Georgia, which shows you what an insider he is. I guess he truly earned his outsider label by all those mistakes. Is the upside of
right.
that.
Well, I wouldn't say that Jim Barksdale is an insider either. I've never met him. I mean, if he walked in my apartment right now, I wouldn't recognize him. Well, except that unless he's wearing his hat.
Well, and then one more question. I'll say this, is that he's definitely not part of the crowd, because I saw that same ad. I was at a restaurant, and I guess it was in between the Channel 2 Noon News and HiQ, the Scholastic quiz show that they put on the WSB ABC affiliate in Atlanta. And they actually ran the ad, and I thought, man, he's got a TV ad and got some points behind it. I have no clue how many. And so I went on his website, and I actually heard the audio, saw the hats. I heard the word crowd, I don't know how many times. He's not a part of the Washington crowd and the Wall Street crowd.
Oh, but David, the best two lines are, I'm not a politician. I have a hat. Like somehow wearing a hat proves that you're not a politician.
Oh, man.
Yeah. Well, Abraham Lincoln had a hat, too. I thought he was a politician. Actually, a well-respected one. Tim, what are your thoughts on this Senate primary?
Well, may the best man lose. That's about the way I'm looking at it now. I just don't think it matters. You know, you got this guy suing. And he says the party already has its pick in Jim Barksdale. And, you know, Coyne might be right about that. He paid a $5,250 entry fee. And he's saying he and the Copeland lady threw their money away because the fix is in. I didn't know that when I voted, but I'm glad to know I was part of the fix. This is ridiculous. It'll be summarily dismissed. But more important, it's just more bad publicity that the party does not need. And
exactly.
I'm real fearful that we're gonna take quite a beating in that race in November, regardless of what happens, even in the presidential race.
Well, let me ask you, and I think that, you know, the vote's going to come very close to the presidential vote. We can talk about that poll later. But I get the sense that, of course, John Coyne trying to sue the party, he's turning people off left and right, no doubt about it. He's looking like a total gadfly. But then Jim Barksdale, they built up these expectations, and I don't know that he's matching or exceeding anyone's expectations. He's underwhelming mine. To consider they recruited him. Now, I'll say this. Cheryl Copeland, I think if she was running for, say, state house, maybe state senate, you know, around her house, I believe she's from Paulding County, possibly that district she lives in would go into part of Douglas, she might be a decent candidate. She doesn't look ready for the U.S. Senate, just being honest. Now, I'm not saying she can't get better. But do you think that so many people are going to be turned off by the two gentlemen in the race because they're kind of back and forth and doing some odd things, and she's not. Catherine, do you think some people are just going to vote for her almost by default?
No, because nobody knows about any of this. You know, she might get more votes because she's a woman, but I don't think it has anything to do with all this other stuff because, it's so inside baseball. Nobody's paying attention except us, you know,
those of us
who pay attention.
That's
nobody
right.
cares. Nobody pays any attention. Thing that is troubling to me is that, you know, we have a handful of, good, solid Democrats in the state House, the state Senate, in our larger counties and in municipal leadership roles, elected leadership roles, but nobody is willing to run for Senate. And I've talked to some of these people about it. Like, why don't you run for Senate? And they're like, oh, I don't want to run for Senate. I want to be the governor, or I want to be the Secretary of State. They want to stay here. They don't want to go to Washington. So I think that's a problem. Like, nobody wants to go to Washington. They want to stay here and be the governor, or they want to stay in the House, in the State House. And I admire that. I'm not criticizing that. But I think we have a – it's a problem because I don't think you can roll out of bed one morning and say, oh, I've never run for office and I've never really been political, but I think I'll run for the U.S. Senate. Like, it just doesn't make sense to me.
Mm.
Right? I mean,
yeah,
it's a statewide election. You need to have contacts in Valdosta and up where Tim lives and, you know, almost to Alabama. And I just, I think it's a really mysterious idea that you can just think that you just, like I said, roll out of bed one morning and run for one of the hundred most important positions in the world.
Mm-hmm. No. Well, I mean, the thing is I guess that shows the lack of, you know, bench on the Democratic side, although I guess maybe for some of these candidates there's an appeal if they put their name on the ballot in a presidential year. You know, they're probably going to get more than a million votes, and maybe there's a you know, narcissistic effect. Hey, I was the nominee.
Well,
you know, I got more than a million votes.
That's
that was
great.
Exciting.
That's just
the standard
terrific,
bearer.
Isn't it? Yeah, that's
I,
just
I,
terrific.
I'll
tell you what, I'll bet you right now that our Senate candidate don't get 40% of the vote in November. I bet you that our presidential candidate exceeds that by 8 to 10 points.
I agree.
Well,
that's
Tim,
what I
bet. I'll take, and Catherine, I'll take that bet. Give me
41%
plus. I will.
You
I
will.
Don't know what we'll have any kind of stakes on it, but I'll take it. And I, here's what the crazy thing is. I don't even have to know which one of the three it is. I'll take the Democratic nominee, 41%.
You know,
I didn't say 40
I'll
plus 1.
Pot,
I said 41%.
I'll sweeten the pot for you. I'll sweeten the pot for you. I'm going to
do
say that.
That
15% of the vote that Johnny Isaacson gets will also vote for Hillary Clinton.
Okay, a lot of crossover voters. We'll have to – in fact, maybe if the listeners want to come up with some reasonable stakes on Facebook, I mean, we're not betting car titles or anything here. I mean, it's not – it's all friendly and all, but come up with some
I'll
stakes
send you a button.
And we'll figure it out. Yeah, so – But that's what I think. And here's the, but Tim, I want to ask you the same kind of question I posed to Catherine. Do you think that all this bickering between John Coyne and Jim Barksdale, and then the Jim Barksdale rollout kind of being a little odd with the hat, do you think that Cheryl Copeland will reap the benefits and possibly win the nomination?
You know, I don't think so. I think maybe Barksdale's money and the fact that he's been able to get on TV will get him enough votes to be the nominee. I walked into the booth. I've early voted already, and I voted for him. I didn't even have a clue who the other two people were, to be honest with you. I hadn't heard about that lawsuit yet. I didn't really know anything about the Copeland lady, so I just voted for the one I knew something about, thinking, well, he's the handpicked person of the party, so let's go with him and see what happens. So, Catherine's right. It's inside baseball. The inside baseballers are probably going to vote for
him. Yeah. Yeah. Well, let's stay in Georgia but switch topics up.
I just have one more thing to say. The
one
thing I will say is I just hope we don't have a freaking runoff. Let's like get one person.
Oh, goodness.
Because that's just going to be a mess.
Wouldn't that be absolutely nuts if Barksdale and Copeland get in the high 40s and Coyne gets just enough because they're so split? I mean, that would be so weird, but in this strange year, you could see that happening. Well, let me kind of switch gears. The AJC did a poll. I do not know if they polled this the Senate primaries. To me, that would be kind of fascinating, but they hadn't released it up to this point if they have. But they did look at Governor Deal's approval rating. Also, Morning Consult, a national website, also did some polling on Governor Deal. Found he was fairly popular, but the AJC poll really broke some numbers down that I found very interesting. Johnny Isaacson's approval rating among Republicans, and he is a Republican governor, for those of you that don't know, I'm sorry, Nathan Deal, is a Republican governor, Nathan Deal is, 58% of Republicans approve of him. Lowest approval rating among Republicans he's had. 51% of Democrats approve of the job Nathan Deal's doing. He's right side up amongst voters of the other party. I mean, he's almost within the margin of error between Democrats and Republicans. And this all has to be an effect of the two major attention vetoes. He's suffering among his own party, but he's
gaining among
the opposite party.
And this was after
the
both vetoes?
The poll was taken after both vetoes. It was taken after
that
both vetoes.
That explains it.
Yeah.
That explains For instance, you're talking about only 29% of voters in this state disapprove of the governor vetoing the campus carry legislation, for instance. Over half of the voters approved of him vetoing both of them. So, obviously, and especially Democrats were ecstatic that he vetoed both of them. So, of course, it was going to make his numbers jump, right?
Yeah, I mean, he gained political traction across the aisle, definable political traction. Catherine, did you see these numbers, and what are your thoughts on them?
I didn't see them. I didn't do my homework. But what you're saying, I'm not really surprised. I mean, I know the Republicans, the right, a lot, especially the more conservative Republicans, are really mad, especially about the campus carry. Well, about both of them. But I think that campus carry really upset people, the gun people. And I know that as a Democrat, I was really happy. I was pleasantly surprised by both of those vetoes. So if someone called me, I would probably – I mean, I can't say I would – I have high approval rating, but I'm certainly a happier Democrat. I'm happier
Absolutely.
With him as a Democrat than I ever thought I would be.
Uh-huh. Absolutely.
Yeah. I think with both bills, it was kind of a thing where – you knew what was good for Georgia. It wasn't about what was good for the party. Like, oh, well, if he goes crazy right wing in the next election, it'll push voters, blah, blah, blah. In the meantime, somebody shoots up X college or, two businesses and one big sporting event and five movies decide not to film here. In addition to just being on the right side of history, most likely, that's sort of important to some people. I think when you look at that, you're like, I'm just glad. Maybe we didn't get any political capital. Maybe the Republicans come out harder in some elections, but it was just the right thing to do for Georgia, and that's what mattered
right.
more.
You're
Tim?
Right.
Yep, you're right. And I want to throw a question to you. Now, we have had three polls in the last 2 weeks of this state. Donald Trump's ahead by one in one of them, by two in one of them, and by four in one of them. Are we ready to say now that this is the battleground state?
I think we are, and of course that's going to get into our guest here in a minute when Scott calls in.
Mm-hmm.
But you see, and Donald Trump is so far under 50 that that's not good for him. I actually read, now that's why I want to see the crosstab so bad, and I texted y'all when that poll came out. If you see them, share with me, I'll do the same. But I did read on one of the blogs that the AJC poll underrepresented African Americans in the sample. I guess, their thought may be it's not going to be 2008 and 2012. There's going to be some fall off. I don't know if that's really the case. I think in some of the odd year elections, African American vote has been proportionally equal to what it was in presidential years. There's not been a dramatic fall off there. And so there's no indications that it will be. And so if that's true, and then you can re-skew the poll back to where it would be if African-American vote was the same as 2008, 12, maybe an average of the two, then the race might even be closer. Hillary Clinton could even be winning. And so that'll be interesting to see this cross-tabbed and if somebody unskews that poll.
Well, this question. The 2020 Insight poll said that 58% of the state's voters are female. Does that sound right to y'all?
58%.
Yeah.
That sounds a little high, but I don't know. I'd have to look at trends and see what the exit poll said. It may be right. I just don't know. But, I do know, obviously, more of the electorate's usually female in any state. Well, right now, we want to welcome back to the Kudzu Vine, first time in about 4 years, from election projection
the website, Scott Elliott. Welcome back, Scott.
Hey there. Good to be back, man.
Yeah, good to have you on. Well, we noticed that you just released one of your newest maps, I guess the map that after Donald Trump had clinched the nomination, and mathematically, you know, Hillary Clinton will be the Democratic nominee. So it's probably the first time you really had a clear picture of what this thing looks like. Just give us a general overview for those that maybe ride in a car and can't log onto your website yet. Kind of, what's the lay of the land?
Well, I think, you know, basically we've come to know that the matchup, like you say, is going to be Hillary Clinton versus Donald Trump. To the surprise of a lot of conservatives like me, Donald Trump is actually going to be the nominee. Who would have thought that a year ago, right? But same thing could happen, I guess. But as far as the way the projections look right now, Donald Trump's polling numbers have been par, to say the least, against Hillary Clinton in a lot of places. And the map right now looks more Democratic in favor of Hillary Clinton than it did four years ago for Barack Obama. As a matter of fact, even more than in 2008. So right now we have to say that starting out of the starting gate, Hillary Clinton's in a very strong position.
Yeah. Well, let me ask you a question, because I saw some states, and we'll probably, Tim and Catherine, are giving more specific states, but sometimes you have to make a decision. You have to either look at the polling data that you found right now or have been released, and then you have your gut. Now, I'll give you two examples. You know, Ohio, you have is a Republican state, where and you know, it's been Democratic the last two times. You have Utah is a Democratic state, and Utah, I don't know the last time it went Democratic, but that poll came out that showed that Mormon voters really do not like Donald Trump, and that state would be very much in play. How much, when you're looking at these states, do you use your gut, and how much do you use the data of what's there?
Well, my historical practice is to use data solely. And I think, you know, that sort of eliminates any kind of personal bias that I might subconsciously introduce into whatever projections I'd put in if I didn't use just the data. So, and it's, you know, I think the record has shown that it's a pretty good way to do it, according to election projections track record so far. So when I look at something like Utah and I see that poll, yeah, Clinton's ahead. Do I believe it? No, I don't. But on the other hand, it's the only poll we have, so I have to go with the numbers. Now, I do take the opportunity and have taken the opportunity to introduce sort of an overview of each state. And in that state's overview, I do say that Trump will probably win comfortably. But I think it's a valid point that it's not going to be as comfortably as in previous elections for the fact that you mentioned that Mormons do not like Trump. They really can't stomach a lot of the things about him. So I think that it's going to be an election in which Clinton will do well, relatively speaking. I don't think she'll take it by any stretch. But it's going to be interesting to see what kind of effect Trump has on some of the more conservative states, especially where, you know, there's religious conservatives involved.
Yeah. Well, one more question before I pass it around to Tim and Catherine, and then I may have some states. You also do a popular vote projection. How do you come about that? And you can tell the listeners where it's at right now.
Yeah. So basically, when it comes to the popular vote, that's an aggregation of all the head-to-head polls that have been released for any given matchup. Currently, of course, there's lots of other matchups involved because we're not completely out of the primary season. But as it stands now, based on the last 10 polls, Clinton leads by 6.8 points over Trump. And that's the poll average. So then I use that and I sort of normalize that number to 99%, figuring that Trump and Clinton together will get pretty close to 99% of the vote overall, barring a third party run, which I don't think is going to happen. And based on that calculation, that's how I arrive at the popular vote total that I have on the prediction page, which at this point has Clinton up 8.2 points, 53-6 to 45-4.
Okay. Well, I'm going to pass it around to Tim Shiflett. He'll pass it to Catherine, and it may come back to me. Tim?
Yes, sir. How are you doing this evening, Scott?
Doing very good, Tim. How are you doing?
Oh, I'm doing great. Listen, as you know, the three of us are in Georgia, and we've had some recent polls down here showing Donald Trump with a very, very, very slight lead of like 1 or 2 points in this state, which is kind of making us scratch our heads a little bit. What is your projection showing? Is it showing the possibility that Georgia could be a battleground state in November?
I think it actually, it very well could be. One of the things that we've seen in the primary season between Hillary Clinton and Bernie Sanders is the ability of Clinton to bring out the African-American vote.
Mm-hmm.
Basically swept the South where, you know, a large plurality, at least plurality of the Democratic voters are African-American. So I think that draw for her combined with the weakness that I would see in Donald Trump makes a state like Georgia potentially a very competitive state in November.
By potentially competitive, are we talking, say, within 5 points or?
Well, it's interesting you'd say that number because right now that is what the projection I have based on the two polls that have been released so far this year. So.
Okay, great. Well, now I want to jump way across the country to ask you one more question, and then I'm going to throw it to Catherine. I know you have been watching a lot of U.S. Senate races. I see that on your page. One of the races you've been watching a little bit is out there in Arizona. Senator John McCain seeking, I believe, his sixth term. Is he in any danger of losing the GOP nomination?
Okay. Talking about the nomination, I thought you were going to ask me the general election, but since you're asking the nomination.
Right.
No,
I'm worried about that now.
You know, I don't really think so. I haven't seen a lot of polling data, but it seems to me that I really don't imagine that he will lose the nomination. I do think that he's very, very vulnerable in the general election, however.
Really?
And I see that, you know, with Ann Kirkpatrick, the U.S. representative out there running against the presumed nominee, I guess, in that race, he's going to have his hands full. And then when you also factor in the presidential level polling out there that actually currently paints Arizona blue on my map,
wow.
You know, I think Arizona is really going to be a battleground state, especially on the top two races on the ticket, if not farther down in the House races as well. I've got a couple of competitive races for the Arizona House contingent as well.
So Arizona's going to be a state we're going to be up late on election night looking at, right?
It could be. I mean, things can change. We still have, 5 or 6 months left, so things can change. But I do see it being quite competitive this year.
All right. Well, with that, I'll throw it to Catherine. Catherine?
Hey, thanks for being on tonight. We appreciate your efforts and appreciate you being on.
Well,
I want to talk a little bit more about Utah in sort of a larger framework. So Salt Lake City has really become more blue or purple over the last couple of elections.
Yes.
So as a metro area, I think that's the reason that the polls are tight there, because it is more progressive than it was, you know, 10 years ago.
Right.
And I'm just wondering with and I think there's other states that have traditionally been red that have, like Georgia, you know, Atlanta, Metro Atlanta is, you know, predominantly a Democratic voting area. And
certainly.
And I think that combined with the discontent in the mainstream Republicans if those, heavily populated Democratic areas are going to have a bigger impact this November than they have in the past, because you've got this discontent in some of the Republicans who may stay home or may not vote in the top tier, and maybe they may not vote in their congressional races either. They may be dissatisfied with their current representation, but unhappy, not willing to vote for the Democrats. So, have you thought at all about how those metro sort of blue areas are going to, what the impact is going to be on overall elections?
Well, I think that what you're seeing of having increased influence basically is not going to be so much a function of the metro areas voting more, and I think you're saying this as well, but rather the areas outside the metro areas, which are more conservative, much redder, voting less, right? So by convincing the pool of voters, if the metro areas can vote as they normally do, then that will increase their influence. I think what's going to be interesting in this election is, well, I basically characterize it this way. This might be the first election that no one wins. The one who becomes president is going to be the one who loses it the least. And it wouldn't surprise me at all for this to be a turnout election that resembles 2000 a lot more than it does the election since then. So one of the big questions is going to be, number one, how much can Trump repair the damage he's done within his conservative Republican circles? And number two, how much can Hillary get people out to vote for her? Because in my opinion, I know you guys may feel differently coming from your side of the aisle where you do, but in my opinion, it seems Hillary is not the strongest Democratic nominee that we've had, for a long time. So it's going to sort of be a battle of who stumbles across the finish line ahead kind of thing. talking about metro areas, one of the classic example of that, I would point to Virginia, which is an area that is just the northern Virginia, that metro area up around Washington, D.C., has just exploded over the last five or six elections and essentially turned Virginia from a red state into a purplish battleground state that leans blue. So what you're speaking of about those metro areas is very, very impactful to the outcome of these states, especially in the battleground areas.
Great, thank you. I'll send it back to David.
Yes, well, I was going to ask about a few more states here and there. Obviously,
sure.
Like I told you on the booking, we're not going to go through all 50 states because that's just pointless in so many cases. But one that really jumped out at me was Colorado. You not only put it like a weak GOP, you moved it all the way up to moderate GOP. Or actually, I take that back, strong GOP. It's actually like three levels up. And it was a state that went for President Obama twice. I do think George Bush won it in 2004 without looking at those records. But it's definitely
right.
A state that's trending blue.
Yeah.
Do you think, is this just the polling samples you had to go on? Or do you think there's been some conservative movement to move Colorado back to the right?
Well, to answer your question about the number itself, that's based on one poll taken in November. So you can take that with a grain of salt, really. But at the same time, I do feel like that Colorado is going to be one of the states that Obama won that's going to be very, very competitive, that Trump will do well in, relatively speaking. So I think that's going to be another one, west of the Mississippi, that we're really going to be keeping an eye on. And perhaps we'll be up, past midnight on as well on the East Coast. So you can disregard the size of the gap, but I don't think you can disregard the fact that it's going to be very competitive.
Well, another more global question that actually affects a lot of states. When the Republican primary was going on, early in the process, I think a lot of people, said if Rubio's the nominee, the Hispanic vote may not be any different than it was, say, like 2004, 2008 at worst. Ted Cruz can probably do a Latino vote. I don't know if John Kasich would have been a real damage to the GOP brand more than where the Latino vote is now. But Donald Trump, would have just been a force that almost turns Latino voters into a block for Democrats, almost like African Americans. How bad are you projecting Donald Trump as the nominee will hurt Republicans at the presidential level?
Well, I mean, I think there's definitely going to be an effect that's going to hurt him. It's very evident right now, even this early on, when you look at the map and you see a light blue Arizona and you see a light pink Texas. The last poll out of Texas had Trump up 2 points. So I think it's going to be difficult for Trump to be able to attain anywhere near the level of support among Latinos that the nominees that came before him did on the Republican side. It's always going to be a tough demographic for Republicans, but I think especially so with Trump. It's just one more obstacle in his path to the White House, and makes it a little bit easier for Hillary.
Yes. Well, I'll go ahead and tell you, I'm also a sports coach on the side, and in sports, defense is exciting, but in politics, when we're talking about this kind of stuff, defense is boring, so we're going to go all offense here. If both the Clinton and the Trump campaign came to you, and you can handle one side of the aisle first and then the other, and said, Scott, based on what you see, if I wanted to steal a state from the other side, if you're Donald Trump, you look at states that Barack Obama won, and particularly 2012, and if you're Hillary Clinton comes and says, I want to try to steal a state that Mitt Romney won, what do you think the state or states that are most ripe to flip are?
Okay, so let's do Hillary's side first. I would take North Carolina my home state of North Carolina as a prime candidate that she might be able to get. Obama won it in 2008, and then lost it again in 2012. But he's proven that North Carolina can go blue. I feel like that would be a good place for her to start. I think Arizona, which we talked about, is another great place to go. Perhaps the second tier would be Georgia, that type of state. Again, Utah, that's a stretch because just how red Utah is. I might encourage her to put an ad or two there and just test things out. But, I'd say North Carolina is probably the one state more than any. I will point out, too, now to think about it, that Louisiana – as a Republican, kind of scared me from the primary standpoint. This was when the both debates were heated, they were intense, and actually Louisiana saw more Democrats vote or more people vote for the Democratic candidate than they did for the Republican candidate. So if there's a dark horse out there for you guys' side, I would say Louisiana is one to watch. That's just a dark horse.
Yeah, interesting analysis.
Now, from the Trump side, he's obviously, to have any chance, he's going to have to take a lot of states that Obama won. He's going to have Florida. He's going to have Ohio. I think given the one poll in Colorado, that would be somewhere he would want to focus. Virginia is probably not too far gone. It'd be worth putting some time there. If I had to put a dark horse on the Republican side, I would actually say that Pennsylvania might be the one that would be a surprise for Trump. And the polls there have painted two pictures. That we've had three polls out of the last five that have given Hillary Clinton a lead of three, a lead of one, and then tied in the third. And then we've had two others in the same time period that are giving Clinton double-digit leads. So it's hard to say right now, it's still early, it's hard to say where that race is, but I would say that if Trump were going after a dark horse that we were calling an upset, I might pick Pennsylvania.
Yes. Well, Scott, I'm going to pass it around to Tim and Catherine one more time in case they have any more questions. Tim?
All right. Yes, sir. I want to start with a general question this time, Scott. I want to ask you about control of the Senate. Overall, on election night, are your projections right now telling you it's just too close to call, or that one side or the other is favored?
You know, I hate to preface every answer with this comment, but it's really going to depend on how the typically Republican voters react to Donald Trump being at the top of the ticket. It's such an unknown quantity right now that it's very, very hard to pinpoint any kind of definite results. I think that right now, certainly the playing field favors the Democrats because, number one, Republicans have more seats, and number two, Republicans have more seats at risk. So, or in play, I should say. So, if I look at the projections right now, I've got the Democrats taking the seat in Illinois and in Wisconsin. Beyond that, there are I think it's seven Republican senators or open seats that are in the weak GOP hold category. By contrast, there's only two Democrats that are the same way. The seat in Nevada with the Harry Reid seat, obviously going to be one of the most watched seats in the country, as well as Michael Bennett's seat in Colorado, which again is interesting that that's weak considering that, you know, Colorado is going to be more in play this year. So we can see some coattails already developing from the presidential race down to the Senate race. But if you look at the weakness definitely favors the Democrats to gain seats. And they only need, what, five seats to take the majority back. So I'd probably give them even money right now to do that.
Even money. Well, let's just look at one of those seats. You're showing to me in just a razor tight race in Pennsylvania to retain his seat. Is the presidential election moving those numbers, or is something else driving it?
Well, I think the presidential numbers certainly will play there. And speaking to my earlier comments about Pennsylvania being a dark horse state for Trump, I think that, you know, if that were to happen, that certainly would help Toomey out a whole lot. Now, I do believe that in the Democratic nomination, the primary there with Katie McGinney getting the nomination, I think that actually helps the Democrats because Joe Sestak, I believe, was the one that she was battling out for the nomination. If he had won it, I think that would have been an easier reelection bid for Toomey. He wouldn't have been in the bag by any means, but it certainly would have been an easier task. So that's very much one of the ones that are very close, and it's probably a coin toss.
All right, and finally I'm going to ask you one more about your home state of North Carolina because everyone seems to be looking at several things going on in North Carolina, and I wanted to ask
you. That's an understatement.
Yeah, really.
Yes,
I obviously, you might have the most watched gubernatorial contest in the country there this year for obvious reasons. What's your sense before that race is going right now?
Well, I believe that, number one, the Democrats and Roy Cooper, he's a very strong candidate, I believe, in this state. I do believe that Pat McCrory would be vulnerable regardless of what was, you know, regardless of AC2 or any of the fallout.
Uh-huh.
My gut is, going back to guts here, my gut is that the HB2 controversy will do more to help Pat McCrory than hurt him, because I believe that will generate, number one, a larger turnout from those who are sort of Republican faithful. But I think, too, there's probably going to be a backlash a bit about the way not McCrory but the other players in this saga have come out against McCrory. I think that might help him some with independents. Now, that could be totally wrong. Roy Cooper could win, no doubt. But my hunch is that Pat McCrory will actually be helped by the H2 controversy.
All right. And with that, I'll throw it to Catherine.
Well, thanks a lot. I do have another question, and this I'm going to ask you. This is going to be a gut answer, I think.
Okay.
Do you when Trump first started looking like he was going to be the nominee, we had a lot of people say, oh, I'm never voting for Trump. I have a handful of conservative friends who are like, no. And we've had some of them on the show. No, can't vote for him. Do you think, does your gut tell you that that's going to change, that those people will, in large part, come around to support the nominee once it's finalized? What's your gut tell you about that?
So my gut tells me that in some part they will come around. The question is whether that's in large part or in little part. And, I mean, I know for one, you know, my stance right now is I'm going to write in somebody else as a conservative Republican from North Carolina. So I've gone on record to say that. So you got that on
record.
Wow.
You going to write in Ronald Reagan or something?
Honestly, I'll tell you what I'm going to do. I'm going to write in Marco Rubio because I think he would have been the best candidate against the, you know, in this election to win. I think he would win by more than anybody else would have.
I'm glad to hear you put a name on it, Scott. I didn't want to hear you writing in John Miller as a cop out. You hadn't heard about the audio tape. Ahead,
but I think getting back to your question, Catherine, that's going to be one of the big stories this year is how many people who are never Trump right now continue to be never Trump through November. And I'm sure there's going to be some amount of those folks who are going to, when all is said and done, eventually pull the trigger for Trump. But it could be enough that don't, that it would really put him in a place where he just can't win.
Okay. Thank you. Okay, David.
Yep, you're welcome.
All right. Well, Scott, we sure do thank you for coming on the show, and we're going to continue to watch your site. Tell the folks exactly where they can find you, the address and Facebooks and Twitters and all that.
Okay, so it's electionprojection.com is the website. You can follow me on Twitter with the handle @bloggingCaesar, and then the Facebook page, just look up Election Projection on Facebook, and you should see the page there.
Oh, yeah. Well, we'll continue to watch this. And, Scott, if you're open to it, maybe closer down the line, we'll have you on again.
That sounds great. I appreciate you.
Thanks again, Scott.
I'd love to come back. Yes.
Thank you, sir.
Thank you.
All right. Scott Elliott of Election Projection. I tell you what, that was one of the most informative/efficient interviews.
Oh,
you know, we have a lot of interviews that are informative, but sometimes it takes a long time. Scott gets to the point probably a lot faster than me and some others, and just gets there. And so we asked so many questions, but we still have time after. And that was really a function of how good Scott was on it.
And
funny he mentioned – go ahead.
My question for y'all, were y'all surprised that he announced that he was going to deliver a write-in vote in November?
It kind of surprised me.
Me too.
Yeah, he's bold. You know, I guess that's when you're blogging Caesar or his Twitter handle. You're making projections. You have to be bold. You can't sit on the fence. That's one thing about his site. He doesn't have any toss-ups. He goes one way or the other.
No,
he's not into sitting on the fence.
He never has.
Yeah,
he doesn't do toss-ups.
Yeah, I mean, because obviously if I was doing a map, yeah, I'd call Ohio a toss-up, you know. I'd throw Arizona in there. I mean, you know, because I just don't know for sure. But he makes his decision based on time, what he knows. Well, you know, he mentioned the write-in vote for Marco Rubio, and that brings me to a story. It was speculated this week that Marco Rubio, because of Florida's really just late political season, has not even had their filing deadline. Apparently June 24th is when the filing deadline is, well over a month away. And somebody said, well, you know, are you considering running for re-election? And he didn't just flatly say no. Now, he didn't say, oh, yeah, I'm looking at that either. But there are Republican candidates, David Jolly, who, you know, moved on from the, congressional race to run for Senate. I mean, people have plans in place. But Marco Rubio would be running for re-election. He would also probably help Hispanic vote in Florida, where it really makes a huge difference. Catherine, were you surprised to see that story? And what do you think the likelihood is that he will kind of reverse course and decide to run for re-election?
I think it would be awfully what's the word I'm looking for? oh, I can't think of the right word, but I don't think it's a good idea for his reputation. I mean, obviously, he probably needs a job, and I think he probably would win because people like him, I guess, down there. I don't know why, but and he's, you know, got great name recognition, and there's a lot of people who are who would probably donate to his election from across the country. Though all those people who, you know, supported him would like to see him in the Senate, I'm sure. But boy, that would, I mean, it would not be good for the Florida Republican Party, I would think. I mean, I think they would be all mad.
Yeah, but it would really throw a kink into David Jolly's plan, too.
Yeah.
I mean, I saw a piece on 60 Minutes. I don't know if y'all saw that piece. He stopped fundraising for the congressional efforts. Now, obviously, he's not going to be in Congress anymore, but he just said, you know, lawmakers spend too much time dialing for dollars, and it's both sides of the aisle. And I mean, he was right. I'm like, well, why don't you support some campaign finance reform and let's get off the money.
Well, let's not get too dramatic about this, David.
Yeah, but I mean, no, David Jolly was pretty, you know, forthright. Now I'm sitting there going, well, how much does he have to raise to run for Senate? And you've got to dial for dollars for that, I'm sure. Tim, what were your thoughts on this Marco Rubio story?
Well, I actually saw it earlier this week on television. I know that he, when they asked him about it, I saw about him shooting June 24th over his shoulder as he was walking off, and I know he has over a month to decide, but another caveat here that wasn't mentioned in this little story is that his staff was asked the same thing, and they just in lockstep unison said, absolutely not. He's serving the rest of this term, and he's done. And it seems like if he was thinking about jumping in, that perhaps they would have left the door a little open, too, because they just didn't seem to do that. So either he's not running or he is, and he hadn't bothered to tell his staff yet. So I'm going to say he's not running.
Yeah, I don't think he will either, but I do think if he plays this smart, he'll kind of let a little bit of a clamor, you know, build for him. But then he'll say, look, I don't want to be, you know, unfair to all these people that are working so hard for, you know, if there are other Republicans, David Jolly and these other Republicans, and then folks that lined up for those seats. And I don't want to throw a kink into all the process. I want to be a good party member. But I'd love to help the people and serve Floridians
and
all
blah,
this.
Blah.
And
I don't believe
it. In 2 years, and Tim, and he's the good guy, and in 2 years, the governor's mansion comes up and
right.
It's open. And he is
right.
Definitely a different politician than Rick Scott.
Right.
And that is obviously a much better year to win in for Republican. And he could be seen as a different kind of Republican than Rick Scott and set himself up for the governor's mansion.
Right.
And
if
I was advising him, and that's what I'd do.
Yeah, that office is his for the taking, I believe. And I also believe it would be an excellent launching pad, you know, to another national run, a better one than the place from where he came, don't y'all?
Well, a national run, you mean the presidency. I really – that's a whole five-hour show. But I don't know what the Republican Party does to fix their national brand on heavy turnout years because they
mm-hmm.
are in serious trouble, just like there could be another five-hour show on why in the world Democrats don't show up in off years. And so I just think it's getting to where you pick your district based on the census, and then you pick your year to run in based on these two trends that happen, and we kind of know what's going to happen most of the time. And it's very unfortunate because it's really not democracy.
Mm-hmm.
It is a census and then play in the every other year. Well, one more time for just one more story. And, Tim, the show's on Facebook, Catherine's on Facebook, and you're definitely on Facebook. And you actually mentioned how so many people get their news from Facebook or exclusively get
right.
it. But the GOP is angry at Facebook because apparently
oh, yeah.
there's – I didn't even know this – there's articles that Facebook kind of pushes out there, and the GOP finds these to have a more liberal or progressive slant. Now, obviously, all the, you know, President Obama was born in Nigeria without a birth certificate, you know, blah, blah, you know, this made-up stuff that comes out there that we see, we know that that's not liberal. But what did you think of this story when you saw it? And then I'll let Catherine weigh in on it.
Well, there's a section up on in Facebook, as you know. I believe it's up on the right-hand side of the page, if my computer will take me there. I believe it's under, like, trending is the name of the little thing, and it just shows some of the major stories in the news that people are talking about and the hits it's getting on Facebook, and apparently some quote, anonymous sources that used to work at Facebook are claiming that they would doctor that and they would ignore some good conservative stories and throw them off in favor of the more liberal ones and this and that and the other. And it came as a great surprise to Mark Zuckerberg, who has just come right out and said, we have investigated this and we don't find any evidence of anything. And so I've got to be a little dubious of, quote, anonymous sources myself that don't come forward and tell us who they are. So, and I've never really noticed any kind of a bias like that. And I've been on Facebook for several years, and I know Catherine has. And look, Harry Reid's just having a great old time with this. He's making fun of the Republicans in the Senate for even mentioning something like this. They're actually, some of them talking about having hearings about it, while they won't even, like, take any action on, you know, the Supreme Court nominee and stuff like that. What do you think, Catherine?
Well, I think that if you don't like it, then go somewhere else. Like, is it any surprise? I mean, I don't know if it's true or not. I don't really care. It's Mark Zuckerberg's site as far as I'm concerned. I'm not paying for it.
Right.
And everybody knows that Mark Zuckerberg is a progressive. He donates, you know, tons of money to progressive causes. We all know that. He's been very outspoken about his progressive values, about,
mm-hmm.
you know, about minimum wage, about maternity leave and health care leave and all these things that are considered very left-wing or progressive causes. And if he wants to skew the trending topics to the values that he embraces, more power to him. Why else would you – I mean, I just think that it's sour grapes. Like, you want to create your own Facebook for conservatives? Go on, do it. Like, I mean, I don't know if it's true or not. I don't really care. If he's doing it, good for him. I'm glad. If he's not, that's fine, too.
Yeah, I think it's all in how Facebook is viewed. If you said, oh, well, there's this part of Facebook called Facebook News, I might agree that it should be neutral. But if you see it as a social media site, that should not be a true news source that's vetted by reporters trying to be balanced, then there's no story here. I personally, the times I do look at Facebook, which is not as often as a lot of people, I see it as a social media site. I go to,
mm-hmm.
you know, Political Wire, CNN, Politico, because I like political news more than a lot of other stuff. So I go to sources to see my news that I consider news sources, if you will. I actually, and I've sent y'all some stories, I actually like to see what the other side is saying and more than anything thinking about. So I actually look at Red State a few times
mm-hmm.
a week because I want to know,
mm-hmm.
you know, what are Republicans thinking about? Because I think a lot of times that sometimes we're talking about two different sets of issues, and that's why we're so off kilter.
Well,
so if we at least talk
the
about
other thing
issues
is,
that help.
The other thing is when they're talking about, like, they're, like, favoring progressive issues, does that mean that they're, like, publishing stories about scientific fact versus, you know, some, you know, wackadoodle, you know, Christian theory? Or does it mean they're not, like, publishing the crazy anti-Planned Parenthood stuff that comes from, like, Life, you know, Lifeline, you know, .com or whatever they're, the, you know. I mean, what does that mean? Like, we need some definitions. And also, let's just remember that every media source has some bias. Just by what stories they decide not to or to publish. Any, you know, they've decided, someone, an editor decided, oh, we are going to run this story about a shooting in this North Fulton, predominantly white suburban community, or we're going to publish this article about a shooting in a, you know, Southwest Atlanta, predominantly African-American community. We can't print both, so we're just going to pick the one we want to pick. I mean, there's always bias. Always.
Yeah, but
you're right about the bias, and there's no way to avoid that because there's only so much room.
Yeah, there's only
print.
So much you
can,
yeah.
On the internet, you can.
Yeah.
It's just where you put it above the fold, if you
yeah.
will.
Yeah.
Tim, final thought on this, and then we got to run.
Yeah, I was just going to say, I just don't think this has any legs because Facebook really wants to be a player in Washington. That's another part of this story. And they're giving a lot of money now to both the Democratic National Committee and the Republican National Committee to promote their conventions and things like that. And they want to be seen as an unbiased player in this thing. You know, for favorable legislation, of course, from Congress down the road. So I don't really think there's anything to this.
Hey, maybe Mark Zuckerberg could just come back and say, look, for every reposting of Donald Trump giving the taco bowl a thumbs up, we printed a liberal story. It all balanced out to about a million each in the end. So, well, next week we're going to have Dr. John Sides of George Washington University join us. The week after that, we have Tom Jensen from Public Policy Poland did some triple booking this week. So got it all organized. But until then, been the Kudzu Vine.
Good night, everybody.
Guys. We are the heirs of that first revolution.